Hello and welcome to iVow, the podcast broadcast of Voices of Women. I'm Jenny Prisk, the founder and the president of VOW, and delighted to be talking this afternoon with one of the four women peacemakers who are in residence at the Joan B. Kroc Institute for Peace and Justice at the University of San Diego. And with me is Glenda Wilskit of South Africa, who is a prominent human rights activist and authority on reconciliation, who was appointed by Nelson Mandela to serve as a commissioner on the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Welcome to our program, Glenda.
Thank you very much, and thanks for having me.
We're delighted to have you here, and I think our listeners will notice that there may be a similarity in our accents. What do you think?
Yes, I think we do have a similar accent. We both come from the South.
We do.
And we both love a wonderful game called rugby.
We certainly do. And I'm not sure whether I'm in a safe place to be able to mention that my country, New Zealand, will face the Australians in a match very soon with regard to finding out who is going to win. But we also know that South Africa has a superb rugby team, and I just can't imagine why they're not in the final right now. And should we leave it at that?
Yes, we should, because sadly, very sadly, South Africa lost to New Zealand. But I always say that my blood runs black, and so I will be supporting New Zealand.
And we appreciate that. Thank you so much. Now, lifting us from the rugby just to another lighthearted moment, because you shared that recently in one of your presentations. You know both Desmond Tutu and Nelson Mandela when he was living, and you were privy to a wonderful exchange between the two of them. Would you share that with us?
Yes. Desmond Tutu and Nelson Mandela had a very good relationship, I guess both a private relationship and in public. And Mandela, when he was released from prison, in fact insisted that he was not going to wear a suit and tie, as most presidents do, and opted to wear these really beautiful, colorful shirts. Desmond Tutu didn't approve and said to Nelson Mandela, "I don't know why you're wearing these shirts. They look like pajamas." Nelson Mandela then retorted saying, "Well, fancy coming from a person like you when you're wearing a dress."
And I think that epitomizes the nature of their relationship, that they could speak to each other that way. So moving from the relationship between these two magnificent men to the situation in your own country, South Africa, we read about it in the news, we see it on the news, but coming from you, how is the situation for peace in South Africa these days?
You know, thankfully, we are in a post-conflict situation. We've come from a really awful, odious past. We've had nearly 300 years or more of colonialism and 50 years of apartheid. And so, of course, these two eras were marked by severe oppression of blacks, particularly, and of violence, particularly gross violations of human rights that were perpetrated to suppress anti-apartheid activities. So we thankfully, of course, after the elections and with Mandela being inaugurated as our first democratic president, the country went through a very peaceful change. And it was seen by the world as a miracle. In fact, people remarked about how right up until the elections, there were very, very serious conflicts in various communities across the country. But on that election day, people stood in long queues, peacefully waiting to cast their vote. But we have to understand that there's all this intergenerational trauma that we still have to deal with now. At present, we have a lot of interpersonal violence, domestic violence, inter community violence, and sadly, xenophobia and xenophobic attacks. They've been named as xenophobic attacks. And I am very saddened by the fact that we've had to, you know, attack people who come to our country regarding it as a peaceful place to flee from the horrors of the violence that's happening across the continent. So we are struggling with the issues. We are struggling with economic issues. We have a very high unemployment rate. We're struggling with issues of education. Our education is expensive, and many people cannot afford the kind of education, particularly higher education. And at the moment, there's a lot of protest activities happening in the country around the issues of education. And so one has sort of a whole litany of issues that have to be deal with, but these are all the consequences of apartheid.
All these years later, it is very sad, isn't it? Well, it's not really that long, actually, since apartheid was banished from the country, but in an official way, but not as far as the country itself is concerned. Now, in your work with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, what are you doing with that commission to work toward more peaceful solutions?
So, when there's a change in regime in any country, it's important that through that change and through the peaceful transitions, often not peaceful everywhere, but certainly in South Africa, through those transitions, the question about accountability always comes up. And so the question is, how do we hold those who had perpetrated human rights violations to account for those violations? Some countries have chosen criminal prosecutions, the most famous being the Nuremberg trials. Some countries have chosen to have tribunals, such as in Bosnia, and Rwanda had the tribunals in Arusha. And some countries have chosen a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. The Latin American example is always quoted as the TRCs that happened before South Africa. But nowadays, the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission is regarded as a model, as an example of a successful Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And the commission was actually put in place to investigate gross violations of human rights, which is murder, abduction, torture, severe ill-treatment, and to give perpetrators the opportunity to apply for amnesty and not just be indemnified by a blanket decree, presidential decree, and also to give victims the opportunity to tell their story from their perspective. And then the commission was mandated to make recommendations to government about reparations for those who had been violated. And so my role on the commission was primarily to serve on the Reparation and Rehabilitation Commission Committee. And that committee was to make recommendations to government about what reparations should be granted to victims after they have been declared victims by the Human Rights Violations Committee of the Truth and Reconciliation Committee. So that was my primary role. And I also was responsible for managing a team of psychosocial supporters. So these were individuals who were working on the commission who provided support for victims and their families who came to the commission to tell their story. Because you can imagine, telling the story is re-traumatizing, yes, again, to repeat what violations that occurred to you, what had happened to you, and so on. So we provided that support where the testifiers could feel that they are being supported.
Mm-hmm. So they have you as a support. How do you feel about your current government? Is it supportive of the reconciliation?
So the commission completed its work in 3 years. We were appointed in 95, and we spent 3 and a bit more years working on the actual Truth Commission and having the hearings and having hearing all this, the submissions being made to the commission. And then, of course, post that is really doing what I call the unfinished business, yes, of the Truth Commission. Mm-hmm. So the official part of the TRC was completed after 3.5 years when we handed in the 7-volume report to the government. And then, of course, after that, what are the kinds of things that we need to do to continue the work of reconciliation? And so I'm involved in an organization called the Institute for Justice and Reconciliation. This organization looks at working with communities to build reconciliation within communities and between communities. Mm-hmm. And these are between communities that were obviously separated by apartheid geography, apartheid laws, and so on, but also within communities where people having to come together or come from different cultures, different linguistic groups, and so on. We also look at what is called a reconciliation barometer. We've developed a tool where we are able to measure how much reconciliation has already taken place and that still needs to take place within the country.
Has that been a satisfactory measuring tool?
Yes, it has been. In fact, this year we are just having a look at reviewing the instrument itself and looking at how effective the instrument is. So that's a research project that's happening. But we feel that it's quite a sensitive instrument, document, that really looks at reconciliation throughout the country. Mm-hmm. We've also had a subset of the barometer looking at reconciliation amongst youth.
Good.
And looking at how youth view the issues of reconciliation, various issues of reconciliation, such as, you know, integration, people being able to communicate via a different language, issues of culture, the issues of social dialogue, and so on. So I'm quite happy that the instrument is being used and it's quoted very often by academics and others who look at these issues. But we realize that we do have a long way to go. Mm-hmm. As I said, we know we've had 300 years of colonialism and 50 years of apartheid. These issues don't just end overnight.
No.
And it will take generations for us to deal with issues of reconciliation.
I'm sure. Mm-hmm. Now, moving to your role as a peacemaker, you're here in San Diego for 8 weeks living in residence and talking to various groups around the community of San Diego and the wider community. How do people view, have you been able to determine how people view South Africa today?
Yes. Well, of course, we have 4 peacemakers with us. What has been very topical in the last 8 weeks has been Israel and Afghanistan. South Africa is well known in the U.S. I've experienced that. People know about our country. People know about Nelson Mandela. A lot of people know about Desmond Tutu. So there's an easy connection about the history and also the current political situation within South Africa. So I have found that there's been really good engagement with communities here. But 2 days ago, we were at the community college, and sitting right next to me was a young woman who was born in Somalia, mm-hmm. whose parents actually were born in Somalia. She was born in South Africa in Cape Town, and she was so homesick. And said to me, you know, it's so nice to see you from South Africa. I just want to speak a little bit of Afrikaans with you. And then she spent some time speaking Afrikaans with me. But it is also, for me, the some of the similarities in our histories mm-hmm. are very important. And I think that, you know, the history of the civil rights movement, we in South Africa in the struggle learned a lot from the civil rights movement. We learned a lot from the nonviolent resistance and the various campaigns. So we were very close in historical connections in that regard. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, that's yes, and that there is a commonality. And of course, when you mentioned the colonialism, I almost feel as if it's part of my role to apologize. However, I know I wasn't around in those early days, those 300 years ago. Now, looking to you, you are a woman and you are an activist. Are women generally involved in reparations for the country or peacemaking in South Africa?
I love to tell the story about the 9th of August 1956. Women organized a march onto the Union Buildings, which is the place where the legislations are made. And more than 30,000 women converged on the Union Buildings to demand the end of the pass laws. And the pass laws, of course, were these odious laws where people had to carry a pass to move from their townships, from their communities to towns or into the cities and so on. Terrible law. Mm-hmm. And these women came with representations, signed petitions. They came by bicycle, by bus, by foot, by train, in a day when there was not cell phones and, you know, easy communications. Mm-hmm. 30,000 organized by three women.
Oh my goodness.
And that for me is symbolic of the role, the important leadership role mm-hmm. that women play in our struggle. Mm-hmm. But we also understand that women were there to support their sons, their husbands, their brothers, and other men who went when the armed struggle started, who went and joined the liberation armies. Mm-hmm. And also just very importantly, when we started our work on the Truth Commission, we realized that many of the women who were coming to tell their stories were not talking about their own stories. They were coming to tell us about the men in their lives and telling about what had happened to those men, mm-hmm. but not talking about what has happened to them. So we very quickly brought on board experts from the universities, women experts, women study experts, feminists, to assist us in the commission to make it possible for women to come and tell their own stories. And so we had across the country several special women's hearings where we were able to grant women the opportunity to tell their own stories and to tell it from their perspective.
And they are some of the most important stories, as is yours. So as a final question, Glenda, you've had the 8 weeks here, and I know that when the Women Peacemakers Program is promoted and advertised, it's about giving you some rest and respite, except I don't think we give you very much because we send you all around the community all the time. But has this been a time in your life, a pause for you to think about your country differently and think about any different things that you might approach or convey or suggest or recommend when you return?
Yes. Just this morning, I became very aware of how it is now that I can very proudly say that we are a democracy. A few years ago, I was not in that position. Now I can say that I am an active participant in the decision-making of things that matter to me in my country. And that's very special, especially when we interact with people who take that privilege, the privilege of your vote, the privilege of what your vote means, for granted. I was disenfranchised for virtually all my life. So I really appreciate it. This space has given me an opportunity to appreciate that. But related to that, I also am appreciative of the fact that I have such a great responsibility to ensure that my democracy is alive and well, and that I need to continue to talk out against whatever evil there is, whatever injustice there is, to still continue to speak out about against that. Because if I remain silent, there is a possibility that we can descend into the awfulness of our past again. And so to ensure that that doesn't happen, I need to speak out about all injustices.
And with those very profound words ringing in our ears, we will conclude this conversation. So our very deepest gratitude to Glenda Wilskut of South Africa for joining us on iVow. Thank you.
Thank you very much.